May it please the Court. Your Honors, the case we're here on this morning, Shelter v. Vasseur, involves multiple insurance policies and various coverages within those policies. But the key coverages before this Court can be distilled to two central issues. First, the enforceability of the household exclusion in Shelter's farm owner's policy issued to this family that was involved in this terrible accident. And second, the UM coverage in Shelter's policy as determined by whether or not an all-terrain vehicle should be considered a motor vehicle either under Shelter's policies or under Missouri's financial responsibility statute as it relates to uninsured motorist coverage. Beginning with the farm owner's policy, the exclusion at issue is 11 words long and could not be more simple or straightforward. It states, under personal liability, we do not cover bodily injury to you. You is an emboldened term and is defined to mean the named insured. The named insured was Elmer Vasseur, who is the respondent's decedent in this case and is the one who, in fact, suffered the bodily injury as defined by the farm owner's policy. In Missouri, where insurance policies are unambiguous, the rules of construction are inapplicable, and absent public policy to the contrary, the policy will be enforced as written. There is no public policy or statute requiring liability coverage in a farm owner's policy. This exclusion could not be more simple or straightforward and should be enforced by this Court. Respondents' arguments to the contrary seem to center on the fact that in the way this policy is constructed, the exclusions for personal liability in the farm owner policy are set forth first as part of a group of exclusions that apply both to personal liability and to medical payments coverage, and then there are additional exclusions stated separately, some that apply to personal liability, some that apply to MedPay. This household exclusion that I've just recited for the Court is found in the separate exclusions applicable specifically to personal liability, which is the coverage that respondents seek. Respondents have not cited a single case to this Court, even after their, as they say, their exhaustive research. Not one case in the United States that has found that an insurance policy is ambiguous because it includes or states exclusions, some as a group applicable to multiple coverages, and others applicable only to a specific coverage or additionally to a specific coverage. The one case that they do cite from the Sixth Circuit applying Ohio law is not analogous to the case here. That case specifically addressed a situation where a carrier issued, I believe, 12 endorsements to a policy and sought to relate exclusions applicable to one of those endorsements back to exclusions found in the primary policy form. That's not what we have here. The exclusions applicable to personal liability coverage are found in the same policy form. In fact, I think just on the next page of the policy, all within the personal liability and medical payments provisions of that policy. This Court should enforce the plain and unambiguous exclusion as stated. There is no need to apply any terms of or rules of construction by this Court, and the plaintiffs have not cited a single case, have not pointed to a single case where this type of policy construction and the use of exclusions in this way has been determined to be ambiguous by any court in the country. The second issue before the Court, which is a little broader, relates primarily to uninsured motorist coverage. Now, the issue on which that coverage turns, i.e. the definition of motor vehicle as stated in the policy and in the MVFRL, also relates to a couple of additional coverages. And I guess before I should move on, I should note for the Court, I'm sure you saw it in the briefing, respondents have conceded point two on appeal, so I've skipped over that.
Counselor?
Yes.
Since we're on the automobile policies, and that's points 3, 4, 5, and 6 of your argument, do you agree that you changed your points from attacking summary judgment below to attacking a trial judgment at this Court?
That is correct, Your Honor, in the substitute brief.
Okay. Well, so understanding that, don't you have a problem with 83.08B, which specifically prohibits altering the basis of your points after a granted transfer? Now, I understand why you did it, because the Southern District said you didn't comply and refused to review your arguments. But how do you get around it? How do you get around 83.08B?
I spoke a little too quickly, Your Honor. We disagreed with the Southern District's position that we had failed to appeal from the final judgment. It was in the notice of appeal. It was plain from the briefing and from the appeal that we were appealing from a final order of the court. So I spoke a little hastily, but we did change our points on appeal to try to address the concerns or the issues raised by the court. And it, procedurally, this case was a little odd because there was first a granting of summary judgment for respondents and a denial of our summary judgment, and the final judgment incorporates those earlier rulings. And so, in essence, we are appealing from the substance of the denial of our summary judgment. But procedurally, your point is well taken. We disagreed with the Southern District's. It was plain at all times from the notice of our appeal forward what we were doing, Your Honor. But we did change the language of our points to address that point when the appellate court's opinion was vacated by operation of transfer to this court. That is correct.
In your Court of Appeals points, you say the trial court erred in granting summary judgment to them and denying it to you.
Correct.
Is that what happened? Because it looks like the issue that we're talking about, the definition of motor vehicle and the ATV, was tried. So it doesn't look to me like the trial court granted summary judgment on that issue.
The trial court granted judgment on that issue after an evidentiary hearing, Your Honor. That is correct.
Well, that's not a summary judgment the way I learned it.
No, it is not. It was not. That issue was not determined on summary judgment. It was determined after the court held a bench trial on the separate issues. And we, again, relating back to our notice of appeal and the substance of our briefing in that case, notwithstanding the inartful nature of the points, that it is clear that it was the August order after the trial on the merits that we were appealing.
So you're saying it was your points that said summary judgment and should have said judgment, but that you, in fact, raised the issue of entering judgment against you in your notice of appeal?
Better said, Your Honor, yes.
Yeah, I assume that's correct, which I'm going to assume that's correct. But don't our rules still prohibit you from altering the basis of your claim? I mean, we allow you to file substitute briefs, but the rule specifically says you're not allowed to alter the basis of your claim.
And I guess that would be my point, Your Honor, which is that we did not, if you look at the procedural history of the case, we did not seek to appeal the earlier ruling when the court denied our summary judgment motion. The appeal was taken after the trial. I don't have our notice of appeal memorized, and I'm sorry I don't have it in front of me, but my memory is, and I trust the record will bear me out, that it was clear from the notice what we were appealing. The timing of it was clear. The substance of the appeal was clear. The merits of the appeal was clear. Were clear from our earlier briefing. The points relied on did make reference to the denial of summary judgment, and there's no mistaking that. But it was clear from the record, I think, what we were doing. And we did, as far as changing it, where we perceived that the issue to be the fact that the word summary was incorrectly included in our point in the appellate court, we did seek to rectify that when we filed our substitute briefs here with an eye towards asking this court to consider the merits of the issues with regard to UM coverage for ATVs, and that was done.
So what you're saying is that you were raising the same claim in the Court of Appeals that you're raising here. It may have been less artfully drafted in the Court of Appeals, but it's still raising the same claim.
We are not seeking to challenge any ruling. We're not seeking to challenge a different ruling here than we sought to challenge in the Court of Appeals or that we intended to appeal from.
And your basis for the claim of error is the same also?
Basis for the claim of error is the same, which is that the court, on the record before the court, even, it gets difficult, I think, in a bench trial situation versus a summary judgment motion procedure where this court, in terms of de novo review, I think this court might defer to the trial court's findings of fact, if there were any, with regard to the vehicle. But the central issue before the court, I think, is that if the court does care to do that and go back and look at the judgment entered after the bench trial, what the court found was that this ATV was a motor vehicle when used on the highway.
But, and of course, the rationale of the trial court is really not, if they reach the right result, even if the language was in part wrong, that would still not require reversal. It's not a published decision. You don't deal much in your briefs with the point raised by respondent that while the owner's manual talks about not using the ATV on the road, that you're, that they have an expert who says that, in fact, ATVs are designed for use on the right-of-way, which is part of the roadway under Missouri law, and that you answered requests for admission stating that the ATV was originally designed for operation on a hard, flat surface for vehicles to travel on maintained by governmental entities, i.e. a road.
Two pieces to that point, Your Honor. First is the witness that they produced admitted three things. First, he was not a design engineer. He had no design experience, was not competent to testify to design. Second, that interestingly, he testified that ATV policies are available and claimed to have had his own ATV policy of insurance from Shelter, which doesn't go to your point, but I think it's important in this case. And then third, I would point the court back to Meeks. Meeks is the one case I could say in this entire matter that is directly on point. And in Meeks, although it was a dune buggy, the off-road vehicle there was being used on the right-of-way of I-55, directly analogous to the situation here where this ATV was being used on the grassy part of the right-of-way of State Highway AA in Texas County. So Meeks did look at a situation, and in fact, much of that expert's testimony, which you've obviously read, Your Honor, is that these ATVs can be retrofitted to be licensed or be street legal.
The trial court, in denying summary judgment, and then later she entered judgment, said that she relied on the expert's testimony. She thought there was a question of fact as to whether, and she resolved that fact that it was designed for use in the public road, clearly relying on the expert's testimony. And then the request for admissions answers also said it was designed for use on a hard surface. The operator's manual clearly says not to use it on a hard surface or on a road. But why is it a question of law, which you seem to be arguing? She could not reach a contrary conclusion based on, in this particular case, which is, I don't know what the evidence was in Meeks, but here there was this other evidence. Why was that not something she could rely on?
If you take all of the evidence that the trial court found to make that determination and compare it with the factual background recited in Meeks, Judge, you'll find that that trial court found no more than what was found in Meeks, which was that in Meeks you had a vehicle, an all-terrain vehicle, that was being used on a right-of-way that had been retrofitted, in fact had been retrofitted to be street legal, which this one hadn't, but this, the dune buggy had, and the court still found that was an ATV and was not intended to be included
as a matter of law.
As a matter of law, under the MVFRL, was not intended to be included, even with those facts.
May it please the court. There are two policies of insurance involved in the child of this case. That is correct. When Elmer Basher was killed while riding on the back of the ATV operated by his 13-year-old adoptive son, the family made claims under the farm owner's policy and the auto policies. Shelter denied both claims on either policy. And what I'd like to try to explain to you in the time allotted this morning is why the Bashers are indeed entitled to coverage under both policies. First, with regard to the farm owner's policy, let me be clear at the outset. We are not challenging the validity of the household exclusion. That's never been our challenge. Our challenge in this case is the structure of the policy. The Vassars had the options under Section 2 of their policy to purchase liability coverage, coverage E, or medical payments, coverage F, or both. So there were three options of coverage: liability, option 1, MedPay, option 2, or both. And they chose that option to purchase both coverage. So we've said from the very beginning, that because the exclusions are grouped, it's the Group A exclusions that apply to those who purchase both liability and medical payments coverage that applies. And there's basis for that in the policy itself. Let's start with the insuring agreement. The insuring agreement for liability and medical payments is on the same page, the same column of the same page in successive paragraphs. The insuring agreement with regard to the medical payments coverage expressly says, we do not cover injury to insureds or residents of the insured premises. I'm kind of reminded of the Latin phrase, expressio unius est expressio alterius. They knew how to do it. They did it on the same page in successive paragraphs. They specifically said under medical payments coverage, we do not cover injury to insureds or to residents of the insured premises. Why didn't they do that? If that was Shelter's intent to exclude the insureds or residents of the household, why didn't they do so in the immediately preceding paragraph above? Say the exact same thing. They knew the language. They had the language. Their argument was in the trial court and in the appellate court and in this court that this group A are additional exclusions. The problem is that's not what the policy says. They know how to write additional exclusions. They did it. We've also given the court an example of that under Section 1. Under Section 1 of the policy, they have additional exclusions, and they in fact say the following exclusions are added to and will also apply to claims made under this endorsement. They could have done the exact same thing with regard to Group B and Group C, and we've illustrated that in our brief. All they had to say was under the following exclusions are added and will also apply to claims made under this endorsement. And then they go on to say in Section 1, additional exclusions under Section 1. They could have done the same thing. That was in all caps in their policy. All they had to do, if these were additional exclusions, was say so in their policy. The trial court picked up on this in the hearing on the motion for summary judgment. The trial court said Shelter's interpretation, Shelter's argument, only makes sense if the common exclusions, they say these are common exclusions in Group A, and the trial court said their argument only makes sense if the common exclusions are included in Group A, and that's correct. The household exclusion was a common exclusion. It was in coverage E, and it was in coverage F. So if, in fact, it was to be a common exclusion, it should have been in Group A. But it was conspicuously absent from that group. Now, there's another problem, however, in making sense of this argument that Shelter makes in this case about these exclusions being common when they weren't set forth in Group A, and that is this. The exclusions as to other provisions, the farm employee exclusion and the professional services exclusion, are inconsistent. If you look at the way the farm employee exclusion is written under the Group A exclusions, it excludes any injury that occurred during the course of employment. If you look, however, under the Group B exclusion pertaining to liability, they only exclude bodily injury unless there's a claim made within 36 months of the event or the termination of the policy. But more importantly, with regard to the medical payments coverage, and I'm going to read in a second from their brief on this, but very, very important. Under the medical payments exclusion, and let me back up, the professional services exclusion in Group A is just an outright exclusion. They said, we don't provide coverage for any professional services rendered or for failing to render professional services. It's an outright exclusion. There's no geographic boundaries. It's excluded, period. However, when you look at the exclusion then in the medical payments coverage, they say that they only exclude professional services if it was rendered on the premises. So to read from their brief, I've said that these two exclusions in the general set, which they say are common and applicable to both coverages, and if you look at the exclusion in the medical payments coverage, they cannot possibly be reconciled. And here's what they say in their brief. They talk about if a claimant suffers bodily injury away from the insured premises. Now, they're referring to the professional services exclusion. If a claimant suffers bodily injury away from the insured premises and caused by the negligent rendering of professional services, medical payments would be excluded under the exclusion applicable to both coverages, but would not be excluded under the exclusion applicable only to that coverage. Right. How can that possibly be? How can it be excluded under the general exclusions, but not excluded under the coverage applicable to medical payments coverage? How can that be right? Well, the way it's right is because if you interpret the policy, the general exclusions as applying to those who purchase both coverages, that's correct. And if you interpret the policy as the Bashers has and have, that the exclusion only applies if you have the medical payments coverage only, then that's the right answer. Let's talk about the auto policies a minute. The auto policy defined a motor vehicle as a vehicle being operated on a public road or highway. And so we said from the beginning on the arguments and presentation on the motion and cross motion for summary judgment that because public roadway was defined to include the adjacent right-of-way, that ATVs were clearly designed. We see them running up and down the highway right-of-ways all the time. We see the paths where they run up and down the highways all the time. So we said, and we presented the motion for summary judgment, that it was a motor vehicle because it was clearly designed for use on public roadways as including the adjacent right-of-way. When Judge Hickel took the case under advisement, he did some work. He gave it some careful thought, and he picked up on some things that I hadn't thought about when we presented the case on our argument for summary judgment. He says public roadway is defined, of course, as a roadway maintained by the government and its adjacent right-of-way. But roadway was not defined. So he went to the dictionary to find out what is the definition of a roadway. And he found that a roadway was a hard, flat surface maintained by a governmental entity for vehicular traffic. So then he combined those concepts. And when he combined those concepts, he said it's a hard, flat surface designed for travel by vehicular traffic, but he still couldn't enter a judgment for either side on the cross motion for summary judgment. He thought there were contested issues of material fact, whether or not, I guess, the ATV could be operated on hard, flat surfaces maintained by governmental entities for vehicular traffic. So we had a trial. And in the trial, they rested on the owner's manual. That was all they presented in the stipulated set of facts. We presented, as Judge Stith has commented, we presented request for admission responses in which Shelter admitted that the ATV was originally designed for travel on hard, flat surfaces maintained by a government entities. We presented extensive testimony from Brian Powers. Brian Powers had been selling ATVs for years. Had sold some 20,000 ATVs and had served on committees with Honda. Had met with senior level engineers from Kawasaki and helping design from top to bottom, end to end ATVs. And he said something that was interesting that I hadn't previously thought of either. He said he himself owned this exact ATV and he's ridden it on public streets. And when he rides it on public streets, he had a city permit. Hello, I hadn't thought about a city permit, but when we have statutes, in addition to the request for admission responses, in addition to Brian Powers' testimony that they were designed for use on a public roadway, we asked the court to take judicial notice of section 307.198, and that's a section of our statutes which says that if you're going to use an ATV on a public highway in this state, you shall have front headlamps, rear headlamps, and you shall have a triangular emblem on the back that's 2 feet above street level. And it refers us to the uses of an ATV in 304.013. The legislature has authorized and said it's legal to operate ATVs in three instances. One, when a governmental entity owns an ATV, they can operate on a public road. Number two, any individual can operate an ATV on a public highway if it's for agricultural or industrial purposes between the hours of sunrise and sunset. That's what the Vassers were doing. They traveled 5 miles down to the creek to trap some minnows and bring them back in a cooler for agricultural use to stock their farms. So it was a legal use. And then the third one is, if you have a permit given to you by a city, some cities issue permits for the operation of these. It's not uncommon in the country to see those. Not all cities do. But why would the legislature allow the legalization of the use of ATVs on public highways by governmental entities and those for agricultural purposes and those who hold a city permit? And why would cities even issue permits if ATVs were not designed for use on a public highway? It makes no sense.
Opposing counsel says that Meeks held that as a matter of law they're not designed for use on a public highway. Do you agree or disagree with
disagree.
That?
Disagree. I think these are,
what did Meeks say in your understanding of it?
I think it's a factual issue, too. We presented the testimony of Brian Powers. You know, they say Meeks is directly controlling in this case, and Meeks, there was no expert opinion. Meeks was a definition of an uninsured motorist vehicle, one that was mainly designed for use off a roadway, except while it was being used on a roadway. It's much different than this case. I think it was the evidence that the trial court heard, and the court's decision was that when an ATV is operated on a public roadway, it's an uninsured motor vehicle.
Why does it matter if it's operated on a public roadway? Isn't it a motor vehicle or not a motor vehicle?
Well, good question. I think it is a motor vehicle, whether it's on or off the roadway, but particularly so for purposes of the uninsured motor statute, it is an uninsured motor vehicle.
He was more concerned about, he was only concerned about when it was on a public roadway, and he was saying he thinks it's a motor vehicle then.
I'm not sure.
Was he saying it's not a motor vehicle when it's not on a public roadway?
No, I don't think he did. Okay. No, he didn't say that. And thinking further about the case, there are some out-of-state cases that we've cited in the trial court, the appellate court, and one of them in this court. The Roberts case was very close to on point on this. The Cash Mark and the Norfolk case. The Roberts case, that's the Illinois case, they used the owner's manual as proof that they were not designed for use on the roadway. And while the court observed that they're not designed principally for use on the roadway, they're still a motor vehicle when they are being operated on the public roadway. So a vehicle such as an ATV can be operated, can be designed for operation on both, off-road and on-road. According to Brian Powers, they have street tires. They have a kit that you can purchase if you want to operate them on the highway. So the out-of-state cases, Roberts, Cashmark, and Norfolk, which we cited to the trial court and court of appeals, are directly on point. In all of those cases, the court said, while it may not be designed mainly or principally or primarily for use on the highway, when it's on the highway, it is a motor vehicle. You know, we've got the cases. We talked about the golf carts, the riding lawn mowers, the mini bikes, other self-propelled apparatuses, basically, to my knowledge, most all of which were found to be motor vehicles which operate on the highway. The Stonger case, which was a riding lawnmower case, and they gave an instruction. It was an ordinary standard of care. It was reversed on appeal because when a riding lawnmower is being used on the highway, it is a motor vehicle. It's clearly not designed primarily for use on a highway, but when being driven on the highway, you got to exercise a high degree of care.
But does the motor vehicle responsibility law require any of those machinery to be covered by an automobile policy?
It's really silent to that. They accept out a farm tractor, but they don't. That's another basis for argument. They don't accept out any of these particular vehicles from the definition in 303.020. You know, the Covert case was a golf cart case, and the court specifically, and it was a DWI case, but whether or not a golf cart was qualified under the DWI laws, criminal statutes, and they said while it was being operated on a highway, clearly it was not primarily designed for that, but it was a motor vehicle. And finally, there's Stott's defense, where they argue that the fact that we would be entitled, if we were entitled to coverage under the farm owners, were not entitled to coverage under the auto policies. Stotts relies on Harrison and says that Harrison makes it clear that the term uninsured motor vehicle as used by the legislature refers to a vehicle whose operator or owner does not have an effect at the time of the accident, an automobile liability policy with respect to the motor vehicle involved in this accident. So clearly it's an overstretching of the law to argue that if the Vassarers are entitled to coverage for the death of Elmer Vassar under the farm owner's policy, that it's not an uninsured motor vehicle. The owner, Matthew Vassar, did not have a policy. Adam Vassar did not have a policy. And the operator, Matthew Vassar, did not have an automobile liability insurance policy. That term is used multiple times in Chapter 303, and it's clear that if the Vassarers are entitled to coverage under the farm owner's policy, that does not count because it's not an automobile liability policy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please, the court. I'm going to begin by going back to a couple questions I was not able to answer very clearly earlier. With regard to the notice of appeal, Your Honor, the notice of appeal was taken after the judgment on the trial court, that on the bench trial, the judgment from the bench trial was attached to the notice of appeal, and with regard to the issue presented, to make sure that we haven't misled this court about trying to present something here that wasn't presented below in terms of the notice of appeal, we said specifically regarding the UM issue, the circuit court held, again, in reference to the judgment.
Yeah, my question really related to the rule that I was reading from really relates to not what you appealed from, but whether or not you'd be permitted to change the basis of your claim once transfer was granted.
And I guess that was in the notice of appeal, Your Honor. I think it's clear we haven't changed the basis for the claim, to answer your question. Second, with regard to Your Honor's question about the underlying judgment, I went back and looked. There is no finding of fact from this expert's testimony or from any other evidence that this vehicle was originally designed for use on the public roadway.
But that was the basis of the denial of summary judgment, is that testimony created an issue of fact, wasn't it?
No, Your Honor, because that testimony didn't take place at the time the summary judgment motion was denied.
Was there a request for findings of fact and conclusions of law?
Not that I made, Your Honor.
Okay, so then aren't all facts found in accordance with the judgment under 7301?
They would. But the trial court said specifically what he found. And what he found was an all-terrain vehicle was a motor vehicle when being used on a public roadway. And so to the extent that his judgment ought to be affirmed if it would be correct on any basis, what he's looking at is not the correct standard under either the statute or the policy. He's looking at whether or not it was being used on the road at the time. And respondents have cited this court to licensing statutes, registration statutes, DWI statutes. But the statute that's at issue is the financial responsibility law. And the definition that controls is 303020, as cited in Meeks. And again, in Meeks, the ATV or the dune buggy at issue in Meeks, it was licensed. It had been retrofitted so that it could be used on the public roadways. It had a license plate on it. Yet the court still found that the essence of it as an ATV meant that it was not designed for use on the public roads and would not fit within the MVFRL. Our last point on appeal, Your Honors, relates to if this court finds coverage under the FO policy. Again, it's not enough that the respondents can conjure up some other way Shelter might have done it or could have done it or did it in some other place in the policy. If the language, if the exclusion itself is not ambiguous, it should be enforced as written. If this court disagrees and finds coverage under the FO policy, what the STOTS policy says is if there's coverage available for at least $25,000 for the tort alleged, then uninsured motorist coverage does not apply. The cases they cite are cases where there was a companion entrustment claim and no owner's policy. They're not applicable here, nor are the Illinois cases that they cite for the reasons we explained in our briefs. But thank you, Your Honors, for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for a well-argued case. The case will be submitted.